time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for July 27th, 2019. The Tour de France is just about wrapping up, and it's been a wild and crazy ride. Stage 18 was shortened due to the weather. Quintana Nairo finally won a stage, and two riders were thrown out earlier in the week for on-the-bike infractions. Just another day in the peloton, apparently. This week has also been fraught with more carnage, including two cyclists who were hit and killed on the same day in New York City, and a very high-profile rider, a past editor at Bicycling, the fiancé of Bicycling's Gloria Liu, and an incredibly popular and loved rider, Andrew Bernstein, was critically injured by a hit-and-run driver in Boulder, Colorado. As a journalist, a rider, and a cycling advocate, I've just about reached my wit's end with all of this and have broadcast the idea of a national day of protest. Thousands of cyclists quietly riding to their state capitals to demand better understanding, education, enforcement, and legal remedies for the idea that it is open season on cyclists. I've seen a lot of interest, and it will take a lot of coordinating. I believe, though, that the piecemeal ways in which we have been trying to stem the tide of all these injuries and deaths are clearly not working. We need a big effort with a lot of exposure. So stay tuned. So let's turn to this week's show. 5 years ago, we spoke with Shane Niemeyer. Shane's story, which up until 5 years ago was documented in his book, The Hurt Artist, told of a young man who went from a troubled youth to jail. While in jail, he tried to hang himself, and when the rope broke and he fell, breaking both of his feet and fracturing some vertebrae, something else happened to him mentally and emotionally. He began to plot a course to become an endurance athlete, even though he'd never run a race in his life. And become an athlete he did, along with a lot more accomplishments. We're going to catch up with him again today and talk about his new endeavor, The Helm, a new fitness app, in a moment. Then we'll take a short break and tell you about a local gravel event before we head to Cape Cod for a conversation with frame builder Alex Mead. Alex's background includes a master's degree in product design, a dozen U.S. patents, four cats, and beautifully crafted steel frames. He's also a classical musician. He plays the bassoon. How cool is that? So let's talk with Iron Man, author, and now entrepreneur, Shane Niemeyer, about his new project, The Helm. Hi, Shane. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. How are you?
I'm great. Appreciate you having me, and it's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, you know, it's been, believe it or not, almost five. Actually, it has been 5 years.
Yeah, it's weird to think about, actually.
It is. And the last time we spoke, your book, The Hurt Artist, had just been published. It was a really tough story. You know, I get a lot of books to read, and I have to be really honest that I don't always read every book from cover to cover, but I did read yours, and I think I told you that at the time. Can we bring listeners up to the present by reminding us of what that book represented then, and then we'll come to where you are now?
Sure. I got to say, it's still really weird to think that I have a book out there, a memoir of all things, and I'm not that old. It kind of is a tough story, I guess, looking back retrospectively. You know, it's basically was kind of a journey through my childhood, my rough adolescence, where I was ultimately in and out of institutions for a long time. And then that all kind of culminated at an inflection point in my life where I tried to hang myself at the beginning of a 7 and a 10 year prison sentence fortunately, obviously the cord snapped and I broke, I guess, broke both of my feet and separated some of my cervical vertebra. And then, you know, that kind of kicked off a, yeah, like I said, an inflection point in my life where I would go on to kind of put my life together, beginning in prison, developed kind of a vision for my future and mapped out what I wanted my life to look like. And part of that was becoming an athlete, you know, despite not having any evidence to support or any indication that I could be successful. And I kind of took that plan that I developed in prison with me when I got out. I was still homeless, but I took that plan and I was able to really start putting my life together from a pretty late point in life. You know, I guess I got out when I was 28 or 29 and I was racing professionally for 5 years later and raced Ironman and half Ironman, did a lot of events. I think I've probably done like 60 half Ironmans and about 20, 21 or 22 full Ironman distance races, and went on to have a family, became a strength and conditioning coach. Like you indicated, I published that book and I've traveled around speaking quite a bit, which I love. And now I'm at the beginning of, I guess I'm an entrepreneur by default now that we have a small company, a group of developers and a partner, and we're creating a technology that I hope will help people. So that's kind of a nickel tour of my life.
You know, it's so inspiring though. If listeners are interested in the story, and it is fascinating, it is The Hurt Artist by Shane Niemeyer, and that's who we're talking with today. So I got this email from you that says, hi, it's Shane. And I'm like, oh, I wonder what he's up to. And you are up to something very interesting. Who's Jim Layton? Let's talk about Jim first, and then we'll talk about Helm, your new project.
So Jim is he's a CEO and director. He's been CEO and director of a couple large multinational organizations. And like I said, I was a strength and conditioning coach. I think he came to one of my talks and actually read the book. And his philosophy of leading organizations is very similar to mine, like a kind of a comprehensive approach to wellness and well-being. But he was just doing it at the organizational level. And I have been doing it on the individual level for some time. We kind of combined forces and started the company. He's currently actually in Australia running the only poultry company, I believe, in Australia right now.
Poultry as in chickens?
Yeah, right, exactly.
I guess that's poultry.
Yeah.
All right. So whose idea was this Helm? And let's first define it. So Helm is an app. I downloaded it yesterday and I looked at it, and it's very simple to download. It's very simple to input all of your data, and then it comes up with some really interesting results. Explain what it was in the initial idea and for whom it was developed and what it's going to do.
Yeah, so, boy, it's been a really long process. Not a really long process, but it's definitely been a learning process. You know, we kind of co-conspired to do this. It's a way to instantiate my mental model of well-being. The ultimate goal is to create a wellness app right now. And what the Helm currently is an app that integrates the different components of what fitness is. You know, being the outspoken cyclist, a lot of listeners are probably predominantly aerobic athletes, which is really important. And the aerobic component confers a whole constellation of unique benefits to the exerciser or to the individual. But there's also a strength component that we know that science has been really clear that's equally important and confers its own unique host of benefits. So we're trying to combine the aerobic component and the strength component on a flexible basis with a nutrition log, a food log and a weight log. And so the ultimate objective is to be able to meet users where they are, what their current fitness level is, and progress them towards where they want to be. You know, there's a lot of technology out in the world, and the current state of fitness in this country is pretty dismal. It actually turns out to be that 70% of Americans, and this kind of falls down right down the middle, 35 to 36% are overweight, and 35 to 36% are obese. you know, a lot of our healthcare costs is associated with chronic illness, and a lot of that's related to just the lack of activity in this country. This app gives users, whether they're sedentary, beginner, intermediate, or advanced level athletes, gives them a path forward. We have a pool of programs, workouts, and exercises for users. One of my concerns was always, does the world really need another fitness app? But after looking at all of them, we felt, and I know we can do it better. So that's what we're trying to do.
Well, one of the things I noticed when I downloaded the app and started inputting some of the data was, you know, I looked at so it asks for your weight and then it asks for the weight that you'd like to be. And I put a number in and it said, no, that's too ambitious. And I thought that was an interesting way of looking at it. It's like, don't look, you know, 6 months down the road. Let's see what we can do in the next. I mean, that's what it told me basically is we're going to look at this short term to begin with so that you get some results. That's sort of the way I felt about it. Oh, well, maybe if I get to there, then the next level will be easier.
Ultimately, what we want is just like the word diet has a kind of a temporary connotation, right? Our hope is that we can create a situation that makes it more easy for people to adopt a lifestyle, that this becomes a way of being in the world instead of a temporary situation. And it's process, right? We want to be focused on the process, knowing that the process develops outcomes. That is the hope, is to meet people where they are, not get too ambitious, and just start the process of adopting a healthier, more active lifestyle.
So now you have exercise, you have diet, you have strength. So then is there going to also be sort of this mental, and mental is the wrong word maybe, but you know, I teach yoga, you might remember that. And so
yes,
there's that other sort of realm that mind, body, spirit thing that gets incorporated. Are you looking at incorporating yet more elements to the app?
Yeah, we have a lot of work to do, you know, with the physical component alone. I guess it would go like this. Even when I'm dealing with an individual in the flesh, I realized a long time ago that I could deliver them fitness, and change happens rapidly because the body is so adaptive. You could take someone that's really even pretty sedentary and in pretty bad shape, and within a couple weeks, they're actually moving better. They're feeling better. Within two months, the conversation's completely changed. But I found that that's not durable in and of itself. That if you're not addressing their mental and emotional states, their motivations, what's going on with them mentally and emotionally, you're not going to have as much success. So ultimately, the goal is definitely going to be to shine the light of awareness on mental and emotional states that drive a lot of our behavior and that can make exercise more durable. So that is certainly the ultimate aim, is to develop, you know, the fitness component first. Why? Because even when I was dealing with clients on a one-to-one basis, I was addressing them physically, because changing the physical state of someone's body is the most immediate way to change their mental and emotional states, right?
Right.
But it's not durable. It's not durable without addressing them. You can't, I've seen, and having raced at a really high level, a lot of my friends were world champions, and some of them were pretty lopsided. In other words, they were so focused on their training that they were kind of shitty people in a way. You know what I mean? They weren't.
Yeah, bereft of anything else.
Exactly. One dimensional. And it's not a great recipe for contentment and satisfaction. And you know a lot about that, you know, being a yoga instructor and doing what you do now, contributing on a broader scale. So that's the ultimate aim, is to not just address physical fitness, although we've got our hands full with that right now, but to address well-being. And there's a really sound body of evidence and science that's contributing to what is well-being. And it does seem to be that obviously the physical component is really important. And just integrating that is, you know, the strength, the aerobic component with a weight logging and food logging capability. And then mental and emotional states. And we're talking about addressing at least some financial component.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. We know money doesn't buy happiness, but it does turn out that kind of rationally managing your money can at least reduce stress. right? So we're looking at that, but definitely the mental and emotional states.
Very, very cool. So this is one of those, all right, the app is out there. The app is free to download.
Mm-hmm.
How are you guys making any money?
That's a good question. We're going to figure it out.
Someday, one day.
Yeah, we have a subscription model.
Okay.
And as we develop new features, we're integrating wearables right now. Obviously, that's going to be really important. That in and of itself will probably lock down some new features. There's going to be users and coaches eventually that want to create routines for their clients.
We'll probably
lock down some of those features, and we'll probably throttle at some point some of the additional features that we're building. But we kind of want to strike this balance, because the whole idea, what's the idea? The idea is to leave the world and everyone I meet along the way in a better state than we found them. That technology is this candle that can light 10,000 other candles, hopefully, or more, without shortening its own life. So you want to give a lot of it away for free, but then you also got to strike the balance of making it durable financially, right? So we're figuring that out. But it'll be a mixed model, a lot of free stuff, and then locking down some features.
Well, again, we've been talking with Shane Niemeyer. He is an endurance athlete, absolutely. His book, The Hurt Artist, if you haven't read it, I read it. It was published in 2014. It's a very compelling book. It's kind of a scary story, but it's a compelling book. So I do recommend that. The app is called Helm, H-E-L-M. It is available for both Android and Apple. It's a simple download. It's certainly worth taking a look at if you're interested in integrating some of the things that we've been talking about. Wow, it's really cool. I'm glad you got in touch with me and that you told me about it. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you having me, and I would extend the following to anyone for sure, because it's early days. I am more than happy to create programs, routines, or hear from anyone that has looked at the app. Because right now we're in a place where we can really use the feedback. And I would love to help anyone personally. So if anyone out there is listening and needs another resource, have a look and don't hesitate to reach out to me for any reason at any time. And we'll see if we can put something together for them.
All right. Well, we will post all that on our Facebook page. And thanks so much for talking with me again. Good luck with the app. It's interesting. It's new. It's different. And I think it might attract a lot of attention. Good luck with it.
I really appreciate you. You guys stay safe out there, and I'll be in touch. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Shane Niemeyer's book, The Hurt Artist, is still one of the most interesting stories, although a bit scary, I've ever read. If you're interested in his app, The Helm, you can find it on both the Android and Apple platforms in their respective app stores. And it's free! So let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk with frame builder Alex Mead. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back. I'm Diane Jenks, and you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Here's a quick note about an upcoming event, the Magnolia Gravel Galore in Magnolia, Ohio. I didn't even know we had a Magnolia, Ohio. It's scheduled for Saturday, August 17th. The event offers three categories, including a 25 and 36-mile short race, as well as 60-mile distances for both men and women. There is food, there's beer, there's ice cream, there are prizes for top finishers in the men's and women's races, including cash. And for more information, if you're interested, log on to bikereg.com/magnolia-gravel-galore. It's good to see gravel racing growing in our area. So let's get back to the show. Discovering early that he didn't want to make a living in either music or physics, Alex Mead decided instead on a mechanical engineering degree. Then he headed from Northeast Ohio out to California to Stanford for a master's in product design. He spent some time with IBM and its subsidiary Lexmark and eventually found his way back east, where for the past 20 years, he's established himself as a craftsman of fine bicycles, makes frame building tools, and teaches frame building. He still plays classical music in a local orchestra, and apparently he loves maple syrup. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this morning.
Good morning to you, and it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, you know, I love talking to frame builders. I'm really pleased to be able to chat with you today. We were kind of chatting before we went on air, and I learned some things that I didn't know. It's not on your website that actually you went to school here in Northeast Ohio.
Yeah. I started out as a music and physics major at Oberlin College and realized I didn't want to make a living doing either of those, and wound up getting a mechanical engineering degree from Case Western. So I'm quite familiar with Northeast Ohio and really have very good memories of it and would even consider living there again.
Yeah, actually, it's a really nice place to live. We like it here. So tell me where you grew up. And then how you got into the bike business will be the next part.
Oh, my gosh. Well, yeah, I grew up, everybody asks if I had a military family, but really, no. I was born in California, where my father was in graduate school, and then lived up until about ninth grade on Cape Cod on the eastern end of Massachusetts, and then went to high school in Colorado. So I've lived in a bunch of places, and it was really in Massachusetts that I started doing a lot of cycling. And the reason was simple, that in summer, the area was overrun basically with tourists, and it was impossible to get anywhere by car. So my family pretty much got around by bicycles, as it was the most efficient way to get around town. And I think the car left the garage maybe once a week to go to the grocery store in summer. So really, I was introduced to cycling at a very young age.
So you lived on Cape Cod?
Yes, in Falmouth.
Very interesting. We were there last year. It's the first time I've spent any like extended time there for a few days. And we started sailing, and I fell in love with sailing. So,
oh, wow.
We're hoping we can get into that a little more. Well, interesting. So you went to school here for undergraduate, but you actually went to Stanford for a master's?
Yeah, I have a master's in product design from Stanford. And I worked for IBM for a number of years, and then a company that they spun off called Lexmark that designed and made printers.
Right.
And so I basically spent most of my career, believe it or not, my professional career, designing laser printers.
How interesting. Well, you also hold 12 U.S. patents. What kind of things are they? Were they related to the Lexmark stuff?
Yeah, they are the assignee, as it's called in the lingo, is either Lexmark or IBM, but those are all patents related to the technology that goes inside laser and inkjet printers. So, hence, many of them are still being used today. Some were quite fundamental. Others were, in the lingo, not so important, but, you know, we felt it was worth spending the money to protect them.
Sure. Interesting. Very interesting. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Alex Mead. We're going to talk about his work as a frame builder, as a tool designer, and also as a randonneur, because PBP is coming up this year. So
it's yet a few weeks. Yes.
I know. You're not going this year, are you?
No, I'm not. That's quite a preparation process.
I probably would
have begged off talking to you this morning if I was going to PPP this year.
That's probably true. When I think about that, we have a lot of clients going, especially one who will be competing in his ninth consecutive.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. That's got to be a record of some sort.
He does hold the record. I think he's one other person may hold the record with him. He wants to do 10 before he retires from PBP.
Oh my gosh. And for our listeners that don't understand what that means, it's only held every 4 years.
Right.
So if you do 10 of them, that means you have to do it for 40 years,
assuming
you don't miss one. Yeah.
And he hasn't.
That's quite a run.
Right,
yes.
Right. So finally, the last PBP, which was 4 years ago, we finally built him a custom bike. He'd been riding, I hate to use the word junk, But yeah, he'd been riding junk up until then, and now he's riding a really cool bike. But he does not hold a record like you hold.
Oh, well, that's a different kind of record. Yeah, I will never do 10 of them because, well, I'd be really old by then. So I ended up doing it very fast, which got me in the record books for that particular ride.
It certainly did. So let's talk about your frame building. When I went through your site, which is very comprehensive, anybody who's interested can go to Alex Meade, M-E-A-D-E, there's an E at the end, .com, and see some of these really, really cool bikes. But there are also a lot of other things on the site that you do. You talk about perfect. It looks like you do perfect machines one at a time. What are some of the processes that you use that maybe other frame builders might not?
I think we all use very similar processes. The difference comes down to, in my opinion, the level of acceptability of tolerances in an engineering world. That's what the term that's used is, but how far off the desired perfect dimension you can be and still have an acceptable bike. And I believe I work to tolerances that are probably a little tighter than most builders. It takes more time. And although it may not make any difference in the way the bike rides, it's a personal thing to make them as perfect as possible. And so I just to satisfy my own desires, I make them more perfect than they need to be a perfectly rideable bike. And I know that having measured many bikes made by other people, both custom and non-custom, that come through my shop for modifications and what have you. And so I usually take that opportunity to measure them and see how accurately they're made. And you know, it's pretty interesting to learn that a bicycle that may not be super accurately made rides just fine. So they don't need to be as perfect as I make them, but I like them to be.
Well, I think we call that the artist in you.
Or the engineer, maybe.
Or a combination of both.
Yeah,
yes,
right.
I totally get that. Who's your typical client?
My typical client is a randonneur, and most randonneurs are a little older than, say, road racers. So my typical client is age 50 to 70, has been riding for most of their life, knows exactly what they want, and can't find it in a bicycle shop. And so they come to me. And not being able to find what they want could be everything from tire and fender clearance to a really interesting paint scheme, to they may be a little oddly proportioned physically. And so while they may be able to get something that fits by combining a stock frame with a seat post and a stem, they prefer to have something that's tailored to them.
Oh, I totally get it.
Yeah. And the other thing that happens over the years is people accumulate injuries. And as we age, our bodies tend to be less flexible, and things like arthritis come into play. And for folks that have a set of physical age accumulated physical ailments, sometimes stock bicycles don't work. And so we talk through what exactly is going to work for them. And typically they know from their own experience, you know, for example, well, you know, I really need my handlebars to be this high above the saddle and so on and so forth. Most of my clients are very well informed as to what they need, and it's my job to take what they know and convert it into a workable design that meets the requirements of a rideable bicycle.
Once again, we're speaking with Alex Meade. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. How do you handle fitting for your clients? Do they come to you always?
No, not always. And that's usually part of the very first discussion, how are we going to do the fit? And so it's done three ways. Most of my clients, and I would say at least half, will simply fly in for a day and we'll do a fitting. It takes about half a day. And we'll use that opportunity to get to know each other really well and talk about other aspects of the bicycle besides fit. So that's the first way. The second way is many cyclists that are experienced have somebody in their town that, or nearby anyway, that they trust to do a fitting. And I can work with the data provided by a competent fitter. I usually ask that I talk to the fitter ahead of time just to make sure that the data the fitter is going to collect is the data that I need. And the third way, which happens the least of all, is for somebody to say, you know, I have this bicycle and I really absolutely love the geometry, but I want to move that same geometry into something that's newer and can use modern components and so on and so forth. And in that case, sometimes the geometry and the measurements of the frame are still published. And so we can simply look it up, or they will send me that frame and I'll measure everything about it. And basically, like in the engineering world, we'd call it reverse engineer, but
right.
You know, reverse engineer the geometry. So those are the three ways I do a fit.
So if a fitter from another area, say somebody from Ohio, were to send you a drawing, you could use that drawing, an engineering drawing, a CAD
yes.
drawing. Okay.
Well, it's not even so much an engineering drawing. There are a number of critical dimensions that,
right.
that come off a fitting session that I need. And as long as I get those numbers, then I can design the frame to, you know, essentially the design of a frame comes down to placing the handlebars, the saddle, and the crank in the appropriate relationship to each other. If you can visualize a triangle that's formed by those three things, it's got to be, we need to know all three legs of the triangle and how that triangle is oriented in space. And that gives the fit. Now, after the physical body fit is done, then we worry about things like geometry to give desired steering characteristics, you know, whether or not the bike is going to carry a load on the front or the rear, tire clearance, fender clearance, so on and so forth. But number one is to get the personal fit data from the cyclist.
Perfect. Perfect. You work exclusively, I guess, in steel and stainless steel.
Correct.
Okay. And you braze your frames, lugged or fillet.
That's right.
How do you counter the always, oh, steel's so heavy comment, which, of course,
well,
I know the answer, but I want to hear your
yeah.
answer.
Well, and so typically those comments come from non-cyclists.
No, that's
people
true.
People who are, let's say they're not, you know, they don't live, eat, and breathe cycling every day. And many of those folks are folks that stop by my shop. And they say, well, isn't steel heavy? And I reach over and hand them a tube. And they say, well, wait a minute, this is steel?
Right, exactly. Are
because,
you sure?
You know, yeah, it's like, oh, I see. For those that are interested in a little more in-depth conversation, I remind them that these bicycles are custom made. So, for example, if I've got a 135-pound person standing in front of me, you know, I can explain to them that I'm going to tailor that frame to them, which is going to be a very different frame than if they were a 6'2", you know, 245-pound person. Whereas an off-the-shelf bike needs to be designed with the worst case in mind. So if you're a 135-pound rider, you're going to go into a bike shop and buy a bike that could be ridden by a 245-pound person, and it's going to be a lot heavier than it needs to be. So in addition to the fact that modern steels are very thin and the metallurgy has improved, it's not your father's steel, as we would say, the fact that it can be tailored to the individual cyclist usually means the result is going to be lighter. And quite honestly, I can make a steel frame, a custom steel frame that weighs less than a lot of aluminum and carbon fiber frames that are off the shelf.
I totally believe that. I totally yeah. believe that. So I wanted to ask you about, since the demise of True Temper, whose tubing are you basically using these days?
I use a lot of Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
And I use a lot of, for stainless steel, it's either Columbus or KVA, which is a U.S. company out in California. So primarily Columbus and KVA, but also Dedachai. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Dedachai,
thank you. I've yeah. never quite gotten that.
The only reason down. I know that is because Joe Bringelli is here.
Oh, right, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. He would correct us on that.
Yes, he would.
But the thing about modern steel tubing is that if it comes from a company who puts their name on it, it's good. The bar is so high today for bicycle tubing that any name brand tubing is going to be good stuff. You can go read the mechanical specifications and the strengths and so on and so forth. And, you know, you can pick your tubing that way. But if it's made by a reputable company, it's going to be really good. And so then it comes down to what I can get. And so, you know, when I design a frame, I look, you know, it results ultimately in a list of tubes I need to get, both diameter, but also thickness and where the butting is in the tube. And so I then look at all my suppliers and say, well, okay, who has what I need? And quite typically it's Columbus, just because they offer a huge range and it's usually in stock, and I've never had a problem with Columbus tubing. So I don't have a lot of reason not to use Columbus unless they simply don't have a tube I need.
Right, right. Do you make your own forks?
Of course, yes. I mean, well, not of course, but yes, I do.
Great answer.
Yeah, right.
Of course.
I like to. And, you know, interestingly, so in going back to the weight discussion,
right,
there is one place where significant weight savings can be gained by not using steel, and that's in a fork. It turns out the steerer tube is probably the heaviest tube in a bicycle. And so I tell clients that if you really want to save some weight, replace the steel fork or use a carbon fork instead of a steel fork. That is a place in a frame where true weight savings can be gained by using carbon.
Right. Yeah. The only issue with carbon are things like if you want to use a cantilever brake or...
Right. Or a mount fender or a rack.
Right. Or rack. Or, right.
Yeah,
right. Right. Right.
Or
right.
tire clearance in general. So, and that usually comes out to be the case. Most of my clients like the way steel rides anyway. And so they'd say, you know, I really don't want to use a steel fork. But occasionally I'll have somebody that's building what amounts to a road racing bike. And they say, you know, I'm going to use a carbon fork. That's fine.
Yeah, sure. Are you building your own wheels?
I typically don't. I worked in bike shops when I was younger. And one of the things I learned was being a good wheel builder means you need to stay in practice doing it. And
that's
I don't
true.
Do it. I just don't do it enough to stay in practice. So I will almost always farm out wheel building.
Hmm. How do you feel? Everybody who talks to me knows I ask this question. How do you feel about road discs?
Okay. So
I'm good. I can't wait to hear this.
Yeah. So they stop the bike just fine. That's the bottom line. You know, every type of brake has its pros and cons. You know, obviously, disc brakes are better in the rain and so on and so forth. On the con side, on a road bike, they still add about a pound to the overall bicycle. So if you're okay with the pros and the cons, then wonderful. I will happily build a road bike with disc brakes. What I caution people about, though, is part of that weight comes from increased tube thicknesses in the fork. So to build a fork that's capable of withstanding the loads applied by a disc brake, one has to use thicker fork blades. And the reason, it's not that they have more braking power, it's that a disc brake applies force to the fork out in the middle of the blade instead of up at the crown and down at the axle. So one simply has to use thicker fork blades in order to make a safe fork for discs. When that's done, the fork becomes a harsher ride. So you give up a little ride, in my opinion, to use discs on a road bike. So is it a problem? You know, I can go all the way to the extreme of saying, well, discs are just a problem looking for a solution looking for a problem. But no, they have their own pros and cons. And if somebody wants disc brakes, then okay, we'll put disc brakes on. You know, I'm fond of saying that as long as you're not trying to do something that's unsafe or violates a law of physics, let's do it. That's what that's what the custom bike world is all about.
That's true.
You know, I have built bicycles with down tube friction shifters and hydraulic disc brakes. Same frame.
How interesting.
Yeah. And I'm totally fine. You know, different is good, you know?
Right.
That's what, you know, we don't like doing the same thing every day.
That's true. Who paints your bikes?
Right now I'm using a painter in Massachusetts called Hot Tubes.
Oh, yeah. We talked to Hot Tubes not too long ago.
Oh, okay. Yeah. They're right down the road from me, and they're great.
That's good. Their lead time is pretty good, too, as I remember.
Yes, yes. No,
yeah, I know there's some people whose lead times are really, really long. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we're going to take a real short break, and when we come back, we'll talk some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Okay, we're back, and if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Alex Mead. He's out in Massachusetts, and we are talking about one of my favorite topics, if not, you know, one of the top three, and that's custom bikes and custom frame building. So what part of the process of frame building do you think people understand the least?
That's a really good question, but my guess is that most people would assume that a lot of the time in building a frame is spent handling a torch, you know, actually joining the tubes. And in fact, very little of the time is spent with the torch. The vast majority of the time is spent getting the fit right, getting the fit of the tubes correct. In other words, doing the metal work prior to brazing or welding. That's where the time is.
How about carving lugs?
That can be a huge time consumer. Interestingly, though, right now, the demand for carved lugs seems to be low. There was a time when people really wanted intricate and ornate lug work, but almost all of my customers today are inclined toward simple, sort of traditional looking long point lugs. You know, I don't know if that's just my client base or if that's a worldwide trend, or I just don't know. But I haven't carved lugs in quite a while.
You know, when you say that, I think back to some of the real fancy Nervex type lugs and think that, well, if people haven't seen them, they don't even know that they exist.
That's true. Yeah. You know, that's a good point. I'm just thinking about that. You know, so my clients are typically over 50. So
I think they've seen them,
but you know, when I ask, go through that sort of those questions in the design process, it's usually a very strong preference. It's sort of like if you ask somebody if they want a flat crown fork or a sloping crown fork,
right,
they have a
right.
really strong preference, which I've noticed tends to be age based.
Yeah.
So if you came of age cycling wise, say in the early to mid 70s when Italian road racing bikes were it, you probably really like sloping crown forks. Other than that, you like flat crown forks. So, and of course there are stylistic differences that go with the type of bikes. You know, if we're building a touring bike, most people think a flat crown fork is
right.
better. But you know, again, it's a custom bike. And so you can do whatever you want. And there's no functional difference between a sloping crown fork and a flat crown fork, unless you have some, you know, if you're trying to mount, say, braised on center pole brakes. Those don't work so well with sloping crown forks, but nobody's ever asked me to do that.
The oxymoron of fork and
yeah,
brake combinations.
I mean, you know, I just told you I did a bike with down tube shifter
and hydraulic brakes.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. Yeah. So I wanted to ask, before we move on to some of the other things you do, and you do a lot of other things, you don't just build frames. I wanted to know, what is your lead time right now?
Right now, lead time is... My build list is pretty short. I had a huge backlog for the past year, and I've just worked through that backlog. I have a few in the pipeline, but if someone were to come up now and say, "What's your lead time?" I'd say, "Well, let's get on it."
Okay.
You know, but it's funny about lead time. It's building the schedule of building a frame is interesting. The first part is the fit and the design. So you know, okay, somebody flies in, they fit me, or they send me fitting data. Great, got that. The actual design of the frame, where we decide, you know, what it's going to look like, what kind of lugs, what kind of fork crown, you know, so on and so forth, fender clearance, brake type, all those things. That can take anywhere between 2 days if the person knows what they want. So I just have to run out a CAD drawing and say, hey, this is what I have in mind based on what you told me. Does this look right? Yep, good, we're good. Or it can take months where people, you know, people don't under, they want to learn about all the different decisions that can be made in a custom bike. And when I open their eyes to, oh, hey, you know, you, there's like a zillion different lugs and fork crowns, and well, they really get into it. And so I joke that, you know, designing a frame can be as simple as you send me your fitting data and I send you a drawing. To, it can range from that to you fly in and we, and it's 400 emails, quite literally 400 emails to get to the point where we have a design. And I got to that number based on one customer that we literally did have 400 emails. So the design portion can is quite variable, and I'm happy to do it as at whatever pace the client wants to do it, because I really want people to, you know, dig in where they want to dig in and decide, Alex, I'm just going to leave that to you. You figure that out. I'm happy to do it either way, but it can take, as I said, anywhere between a week and many months. I had one that took almost a year to get to the design. So once the design is done, the actual construction of the frame is the quick part. And then there's painting if it's not a stainless steel frame. So, you know, the absolute shortest, if somebody came to me and said, geez, I need a frame in a hurry. And, you know, I lined it up with hot tubes. You know, we could get it done in a couple months. But more typically, it's 4 to 6 months. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's not necessarily based on my backlog. That's just how long it takes.
Right. Very interesting. So yeah. Well, let's take a left turn here for a second. And I want to talk a little bit about something else you do. You teach frame building.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So tell us about your frame building classes.
First of all, it's a blast. I think the students love it just as much as I do. And it takes 2 weeks. And so, you know, obviously, if you can come here for 2 weeks at a stretch, that's great. We can break it into 2 1-week segments if you like. Breaking it smaller than that is tough. But when someone comes in to learn how to build a frame, we work through the design process. So we actually design the frame and then we build it. And it can usually be done in about 2 weeks. So the student walks out with a complete frame. Doesn't have any paint on it, of course, but you know, they walk out with a complete frame and fork that they can then build into a bike. And they, during that time, they learn how to a little about fillet brazing, a little about brass or silver brazing, and they can choose to do their frame either with fillet brazing or lugged. They learn, of course, about design, how to do all of the machine work. I teach them not only how to cut miters and so forth with machine tools, but also how to do it by hand with files. They learn the basics of what kind of tooling is required and, you know, what's absolutely necessary and what's nice to have. So I like to feel that when a student walks out with the frame, they have a really good basis from which they could go do this themselves.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Alex Mead. We're talking about learning frame building right now, which I think is fascinating. And I'm wondering how many students come through. Do you have a set date that you do classes?
I don't. I do it on demand.
Oh, cool.
My current shop is capable of handling 2 students, or so either 1 or 2 can come at a time. And we just work out a schedule that works for both of us. And I just have to schedule it around other things I have to get done. And I have gone as far as actually taking my class to a location. If there are enough students and there's a suitable space in which we can work, then I will load up and bring everything we need and we'll do the class remotely. And that can be a lot of fun.
Sure. Let's talk a little bit about your tooling. You're actually offering tools that you make for other builders. What kind of pieces are you offering?
Okay. Yeah, that's a business I got into almost accidentally.
Yeah, right. I needed this tool and I made it.
Well, that's precisely right. That's exactly how it happened. I made some tools and another builder I know said, hey, could you make me some of those? And so I made a few more, and then I put a picture out of it on one of the, they used to be called forums, they're now Google groups and so on. All of a sudden I was inundated with people saying, hey, I would like some of those too. And so all of the tools I make are tools that I needed myself. I don't really make tools that I don't use. I get, as an engineer and a craftsman, I I'm not comfortable with selling something that I haven't used myself. So all of the tools I make are tools that I needed in the course of frame building. And I call it a niche of a niche. It's a, you know, you can order standard tools off my website, or if you need something that's not on my website, you can send me a sketch and I'll actually be your machinist and also your engineer to help you get it from a concept to something that'll actually work. But that's a fun part, because being in a custom world, one doesn't like to do the same thing all day, every day. So having some tools to make and some bikes to make is a kind of a nice balance.
Yeah, it's creative. It's creative.
It's fun. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's get nostalgic here for a moment. As you look back on your career, which I don't even know how long it is, but I it's clearly
about 20 years.
Okay.
20 years. Yeah.
Which is a decent chunk of time. What are some of the highlights? What are some of the bikes you remember that just kind of blew you away when you took them off the stand and presented them?
Well, there's one on my website that's a four-person tandem.
Quad. Okay, then.
And of course, it had to be painted neon bright green, you know.
Yeah, of course.
What else do you paint a quad? So that's always been a head turner. One that surprised me as being as much of a head turner as it was a mixed day frame, which I apparently hit that just at the resurgence of that style of frame. And so that one garnered a huge amount of attention. You know, and I like the ones that, you know, have gone incredible distances. You know, I love hearing about frames that have gone 30,000 miles,
yeah,
and so forth. The ones that have done PBP multiple times, that's kind of cool. It's interesting when customers show me pictures of their bikes years later, they're usually really apologetic. Oh, it's so scratched up, I'm sorry. And my reaction is, that's cool, because that
means you rode
that
it.
Bike is being used.
Right.
And, you know, I go back to people say, well, you know, tell me what's a good bike. And of course, that's a huge open-ended question. But to me, a good bike is if you walk out into your garage and pick my bike to ride almost every time you go out there, then we did it right. You know, and that's, if that's the one that gets used most, then that's a really good bike. So I love seeing my bikes after miles and miles of hard use, because it tells me we got the fit right, it's comfortable. That's the bike that the cyclist chooses to ride on every day, and that's great.
I agree. So one more non-personal question, although it is kind of, what kind of advice might you give somebody who came to you and said, I want to become a custom builder like you, Alex?
Don't quit your day job.
You aren't the first person to say that, by the way.
No, it really is true. I mean, unfortunately, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, the barriers to entering this field are really low. It's not hard to call yourself a frame builder and make frames. And many people get into the business with the belief that they'll start by pricing their frames low, and eventually they'll get a client base and they'll be able to increase their prices. That doesn't work. So this is advice too, is don't do that, because what happens is there's always somebody coming in wanting to be a new builder and pricing their frames low. And the customers that get a frame from you because your price is low will just go to the next person who has come into the field and is pricing their frames low. Those are not your repeat customers. You need to figure out who your customer base is and target that customer base by doing exactly what that customer base wants. You cannot compete in the mass market on price. It's impossible.
That's excellent advice. Outstanding advice. So now, besides building frames, making tools, teaching frame building, do you have any fun? What do you do for fun?
Well, you
I mean,
know,
it's all we, fun, but okay.
It's all fun. I do like to ride my bike.
Yeah, of course.
And in winter in Massachusetts, that's a little difficult. So I've discovered, you know, this thing called Zwift. That's a blast.
Oh, you are using it. Cool. All right.
Yeah, it's really a lot of fun. It takes the monotony out of winter training. And as we spoke before, started speaking on record, I play music. I still play bassoon. I play in a community orchestra.
Wow, you play bassoon?
I do play bassoon, yep.
I knew somebody in high school who played bassoon, but you're the only other person I've ever heard say, I play bassoon. It's a cool instrument. Yeah.
It is a cool instrument. Yeah, I live in a beautiful place in the northwest corner of Massachusetts. I'm married to a wonderful lady, and we have a grown son and a granddaughter and four cats.
Oh, you answered one of my questions ahead of time, but that's okay. Oh. That's okay. That's fine. Four cats. Okay, then.
Yeah, and really, I mean, don't stereotype me too quickly.
I won't.
I mean, they all have, yeah, okay. They collect.
They do. It's like herding cats, right? Exactly.
Yeah. They collect and we love them.
Well, then I'll ask you the other two questions I always ask my guests. What's your favorite food?
Oh, my gosh. I'm an omnivore. I just love, and being
you're
a cyclist.
Right.
It's all about quantity. You
know? Right, exactly.
So, having recently moved to Massachusetts, I've developed a taste for maple syrup, which is just awesome. But
well,
that's not one of the four basic food groups.
It could
it's pretty
be
good. Yeah, right.
It could be. What about music? Well, you play music. What music do you like to listen to?
I listen to all kinds, but I play classical music, and if I need to concentrate, that's what I play in the shop. But I love listening to all kinds of music. So I'm happy to go out and listen to the local garage band playing down at the brewery or professional whatever, and whether it's classical or rock and roll or blues or reggae, it's all good.
I just realized I should probably add another question to it because we've recently become bourbon drinkers. So maybe I should add a liquor question, but we'll save that for another time.
Having spent 30 years in Kentucky, I did develop a taste for bourbon.
That's right. You were in Kentucky.
My favorite bourbon is Hartsfeld. It's very hard to find.
It's Brian. He's the guy. I fell in love with I.W. Harper.
Oh, okay. I don't know that one, but it's probably, they're like many things, including custom bicycles, the bar is so high now for things like bourbon.
Right.
To be successful as a craft distiller, it's got to be good stuff.
Right.
It's really, we live in a great time, in terms of craft and custom things.
We do. Well, Alex, this has just been delightful. Thank you so much for talking with me. If you do not know,
absolutely, my pleasure. And thank you for asking me.
Well, we've been talking with Alex Mead. If you are interested in knowing more about him and his work, you can go to alexmead.com. That's M-E-A-D-E. Thanks so much. Have a great rest of your summer.
Thank you. And the same goes to you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Alex Mead joined me from his workshop in New England. If you're interested in his work, you can log on to alexmead.com. My thanks to Alex and to Shane Niemeyer for joining me on the show this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember that you can always follow the conversation on our Facebook page, send us a tweet at OutspokenCyclist without an E, or leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. And won't you please take a moment to rate the show on your favorite podcast app? We'll be back with a brand new show next week, and I hope you have a great week this week. Stay safe out there, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.